afternoon, and welcome to Yeshaya. I am grateful, as always, to Rebecca and Mikorot for making this possible. And Joyce, I'm sorry, for making this possible. If you have not yet spoken to Rebecca, please make sure that you do so, because that is the way you will find your name on the email list, the all-important email list with which I expect to send out the sheets in advance each week, as well as, from time to time, I will send out notes after class to that list, following up on items from the class itself. Those who have been here before are aware, I record audio of the classes and post it on yutorah.org. I do expect that once we have the list of registrants in, I'm going to send out an email to that list letting you know where you can find them. That way, if you miss a week for whatever reason, excused, unexcused, whatever, you'll be able to download the audio. You'll have the source sheets already. The source sheets are usually uploaded with the class anyway, so you'll be able to get it that way. But I do hope to be able to keep everybody informed via the email list, so make sure that you are registered. Also note, I do try to start at 1:30 and to end at 2:30. I'm not always successful in starting at 1:30. That depends on when people are here, but I do try to end at 2:30 sharp. People certainly have commitments in different places, and I don't want to hold them up. So if you can make sure that you're here at 1:30, that would be helpful. And then finally, if people could please silence cell phones, that would be great. Much better now than after someone's embarrassed by having their phone ring. So, we are at the start of a journey with Yeshaya, Isaiah. I'm going to keep on calling him Yeshaya generally, Isaiah occasionally, and hopefully at some point we will realize that that's not what people mean when they talk about there being two Isaiahs. We will have to discuss that as well at some point. It's an incredible book. I've wanted to learn Yeshaya for years and years. And generally speaking, the way I learn something is by committing to teach it, because then, you know, I have no choice. But it's such a daunting book. They were all on the back table, right where Professor Sokin is. If they're not there anymore, then they're not there. It's a daunting book, first of all, because it's really long. For those who don't yet know, it's found in the Stone Tanakh that the shul provides on page 954. I should have really thanked the shul as well, Shari Shemayim, for this. Thank you very much to Shari Shemayim for hosting this class, as always. This is now the 10th year, I think, of classes, Tuesday afternoon classes. We started with Treyasar, and then we've just been bouncing around Tanakh. You bet. But it starts on page 955 and it runs until page 1069, which tells you something. It's a long book. 66 chapters, in fact. And there's a whole lot going on. It is gorgeous poetry. It is visions of consolation. It is one of the harshest chapters, if not the harshest chapter in Tanakh, that opens the book. There are political issues going on here between the Jews and the kingdoms around them, between the Jews of the southern Israel, the Jews of northern Israel. There are prophecies about Mashiach, about the Messiah. Some of the most clear prophecies that we have come from this book. It's such a worthwhile book. It's such a worthwhile sefer. But again, people don't usually learn it because it's daunting. It's just that long a book. So my goal this year and next year, to be upfront about it, is after we're done with our introduction, which is going to take us this week and into next week, after that, to basically go at the pace of a chapter a week. This is not going to be like what we did with some of the other books, like Eov, like Ezra, where we spent time on each sentence, breaking it down, looking at language and lessons like that, because in that case, we would be here in Yeshaya for a very, very long time. We'd be celebrating 20 years of these classes, and we still wouldn't be done. So that's my goal is a 2 year is a 2 year trip through this book. Yeshaya's message is eternally powerful, relevant down till today. I gave you a link in the first source to a YouTube video And it's clickable, so if you have the one that I emailed out in advance of this class, or you get the one that I'm going to send out with this on it, you can just click the link rather than having to retype it. But that's a clip from a documentary on Prime Minister David Ben-Gurion. And as part of the documentary, you see him walking with a child and quoting, he asked the child, what are you learning in school? And the child says, I'm learning Tanakh. And you see his face light up, because those who know, Prime Minister Ben-Gurion was a lover of Tanakh. And he starts quoting psukim, quoting passages to the child, passages that he thinks are particularly important. And quite a bit of it is from Yeshaya. His opening sentence is Yeshaya chapter 45, sentence 18. I'm not going to make everybody flip the pages to find it, I will simply read it out to you. But it's a passage which goes as follows. Ki cho amar Hashem, so declares God. Borei Hashamayim, hu ha Elokim, the creator of the heavens, he is God. Yotzer ha'aretz, former of the land. Ve'osa, the one who made it. Hu chonina, he established it. Losohu bera'ah, lasheves yitzara. He did not create it to be empty. He created the world to be settled. Ani Hashem ve'in od, I am God, there is no other. And the message of this sentence, which, you know, it's chapter 45, so think of it next year. But the message of the sentence is one which the Talmud makes a lot of. It's the message that God wants the world to be settled. He wants us to develop it. It's very interesting. On Sukkot, I was in a shul elsewhere, not in Toronto, and someone got up and gave a class about the themes of Bereishit and how you could look at the Garden of Eden as a forerunner of the land of Israel. Which I thought was a nice idea, but I didn't think was correct. Because I'm getting my aggression out now. I didn't say anything during the class. I was upset for 2 weeks. I've been thinking about this. It's true that Adam and Chava are initially put there le'ovdah le'shomra, to work and guard the garden. But that's not the first message we find. The first message that God gives them is peru urvu, bear fruit and multiply, umilu et haaretz, and fill the earth. You're not supposed to stay in the garden. I've even seen one writer allege that the reason they ate from the fruit was because they made a mistake. They were told you're supposed to spread out. If you had left the garden to fill the earth, you wouldn't have been there with the tree. You wouldn't have made the mistake in the first place. But that as an aside, it's consistent with his message, which Ben-Gurion so valued. The message that God created this world for it to be settled, for us to build it up. That's one. Another major theme, if you take a look at the second line on the story sheet, I just gave you, I don't know, a dozen references, 11 references, to places in which Yeshaya speaks about the importance of tzedakah u'mishpat, the importance of righteousness and justice, a major theme for him. Notice as you look at the distribution of the sentences, they're all through the book. There's a little bit of a gap there after chapter 33, because that's where you get a little bit of a story in terms of his involvement with King Chizkiyahu. But all through the book, you find this theme recur of righteousness and justice. It's a principal point for Yeshaya, which again, people invoke down till today. The development of the Jews as a model nation. Right? In the third source, I reference there, chapter 42, sentence 6. This is one that I expect you've heard on one level or another. It's the one in which he declares that he has made the Jews or lagoyim, which we usually translate as light unto the nations. There's actually some debate as to how to take the word goyim in that sentence. Is it the nations or is it us? But we generally follow the view that it is the light unto the nations. Another passage, which is in chapter 61, sentence 9, it's on page 1061, speaks about how we will become known to the nations, ki heim zera berach Hashem, as the seed that Hashem has blessed. The development of the Jews as a model nation for the world. And then, of course, because you have to have this, Yeshaya's goal of peace, right? His vision for the world. I brought you source number 4. Menachem Begin's Nobel lecture from 1978. Listen to what he says. You have to love the Israeli Nobel lectures. Most of you have heard from me about Agnon's Nobel lecture, right? Look at Begin's Nobel lecture. I have come from the land of Israel, the land of Zion and Jerusalem, and here I stand in humility and with pride as a son of the Jewish people, as one of the generation of the Holocaust and redemption. The ancient Jewish people gave the world the vision of eternal peace, of universal disarmament, of abolishing the teaching and learning of war. Two prophets, Yeshayahu ben Amos, that's ours, and Micha HaMorashti, also worth learning, having foreseen the spiritual unity of man under God with his word coming forth from Jerusalem, gave the nations of the world the following vision expressed in identical terms, and they shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war any more. This is a set of visions, a set of messages. The idea that God is a purposeful creator making this world to be settled, the importance of justice, the role of the Jews in becoming a model nation, the goal of peace. These are eternal messages, and they're why the world comes back to Yeshaya, to Isaiah, over and over again. It's also very important, speaking more parochially in terms of the Jews, it's important as a book for our liturgy and our language. Someone, I suspect it was Gita, forwarded me an article from Mosaic a while back, and I hung on to it. And I have a piece for you here in source number 5. It's about Yeshaya. It's about Isaiah. The prophet, it was you, right?
Yeah, no, I couldn't place that name.
Okay, now you know. The prophet whose glorious words permeate Jewish consciousness. Most of the article is about the first chapter in Yeshaya. He wrote it, or published it, right before the Haftorah was read, before Tisha B'Av. But look at what he has to say about the importance of this book to Jews in terms of liturgy and language. He says, Jews look to Isaiah, I would argue, principally for the glorious language in which he portrays both the degradations of his own time and the redemption that will arrive in God's good time. And that language is on overpowering display, not just once a year in this week's Haftarah, but in more Haftarot than have been taken from any other prophet. He is the one sucking all the oxygen out of the Haftarot, by which I mean I complain from time to time that no one learns books like Nahum and Sefania because they don't have a Haftarah. Where did all the Haftarot go? And the answer is Yeshaya. Basically, Isaiah, you can pick a random Haftarah and you have about a 50-50 chance, if not more, that it's going to be from him. What is more, Haftarot aside, Isaiah is quoted so frequently in the daily prayers as to be considered perhaps the third author of the Siddur, lagging behind only Moses and David. Among the multitude of passages in the Siddur containing the work of this one prophet is holy, 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 kadosh, 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 that's him, that recurs several times in the daily service. Many of the 19 blessings in the Amidah prayer also close with phrases from Isaiah extolling the Lord as merciful, redeemer of Israel, and gatherer of the exiles, restorer of righteous judges. Even the daily morning prayer describing God as forming light and creating darkness, that's from Isaiah, as is the morning blessing who strengthens the weary. The list goes on and on. Thanks to it, Isaiah's words and phrases more thoroughly and more deeply than those even of Moses have entered and permeated the spoken Hebrew tongue. My mother, for instance, when complaining about something my brother and I had or hadn't done, always quoted with relish Isaiah's opening lines about troublesome sons. Much as a literate English woman would have turned to King Lear's, how sharper than a serpent's tooth it is to have a thankless child. And it's true. When Isaiah begins by describing the children of Israel as banim lo emun bam, faithless children, that's become a phrase that people use, and so much more within the book. Passages from Yeshaya have also been the focus of controversy regarding the role of the nations themselves and their relationship with the Jews. Whether we're talking about the second chapter in Yeshaya, which Begin referred to here, in which he talks about the nations in the future streaming to Jerusalem saying, "Let us study your Torah." Or the classic 11th chapter of Yeshaya, which talks about, has a vision of, is it? Sure, here. Which has a vision of Mashiach. It talks about this leader who's going to judge simply by smell. the Bahari Cho, he's going to smell, and that's how he's going to know which you know, who is right and who is wrong. An influence on a popular 1960s pop song, I believe. The by sense of smell? No? That came from him. That's built on Yeshaya. All right, I'll tell you after I close the recording. The,
I can't believe we acknowledged your memory.
Sorry? No one? Really? Okay. The reference in you know, the reference to the nations, the Or LaGoyim, that we should be a light unto the nations, or most popularly, certainly in the Christian world, the 53rd chapter, right, the suffering servant, right, which the Christians adopted as their basis for a lot of their legend. It comes from there, and they claim that it predicts Christianity. There's so much here within the book. But lest I spend too much time talking about the book, and not the person himself, I gave you a reference here in source number 6, which is going to be very important when we get to Yeshaya's 6th chapter. The Talmud points out that there are two prophets in Tanakh who envision God's throne room. One is Yeshaya, and the other is Yechezkel. The 6th chapter in Yeshaya, the 1st chapter in Yechezkel. But they describe it very differently. Yechezkel has this whole sound and light show. A lot of it is about angels of different kinds and fire and stunning visions. And Yeshaya is much more focused, as we'll see, on the message. What's actually being said. What is actually being done. And the Talmud is bothered by it. And Rava, writing in the Talmud, explains why. Amar Rava, Kol shera'a Yechezkel ra'a Yeshaya. They saw the same thing. Everything Yechezkel saw, Yeshaya saw. What is Yechezkel like? Leben kfar shera es hamelach. Yechezkel was like a villager who had a chance to see the king. And so he's really awed by the cool robes and the artwork and the gold and all of that. What is Yeshaya like? Leben krach shera es hamelach. Somebody urban, dwells in the city. What is he talking about here? What is Rava referring to when he says that Yechezkel is like some villager and Yeshaya is an urban, you know, city type of a guy?
Well, Yeshaya, this wasn't extraordinary. I mean, it was extraordinary, but it wasn't something as awe-inspiring it would be for somebody from a village who'd never seen anything.
Right, but why is this his experience?
Wasn't he from a special family, a noble family?
Right, so part of it is going to be that we're going to talk about this, that he comes from nobility. That's a piece of it. And part of it is that he's a dweller of Yerushalayim. He lives in Yerushalayim, which is the capital. It's the seat. You see the king all the time. You see the trappings of royalty, and indeed we're going to see he's related to royalty, how closely we have to discuss. And so he's not as awed by grandeur. Whereas Yechezkel, completely different person. Yechezkel is the end of the First Temple period and then the Babylonian exile. He's not used to seeing royalty, except as it, you know, tramples us and, you know, exiles us out of our land. That's his vision of Nebuchadnezzar. So we need to learn not just about the book and its messages, but more about this prophet who was close to royalty, who lived in Jerusalem at a pivotal time, and who saw what was coming and took steps to try, not successfully, to prevent it. So, as I said at the outset, I would like to do about a chapter a week. My goal is, in terms of the book, to gain an understanding of the book itself, its major questions, its themes, to develop appreciation as much as we can in the time that we have for the art of the book, its use of language, its use of imagery. You can't do it without understanding the, you know, certain elements of just the art of it. But more broadly, to get a picture of Jewish life in his day. Secular historians place him in the 8th century before the Common Era. Classic Midrashic history will put him about 150 years later than that. This is a period that includes both wealth and poverty within the Jewish world. Grandeur and fear. And to understand the messages for Jews facing the questions of Yeshaya's day. Because many of those questions, believe it or not, are relevant again today. So he lives in a society, a Jewish society, which is not downtrodden. This is not Shtetl Europe. He has a wealthy class that he deals with, even as he also has those Jews who are not in that stratum of society? What are the expectations of people of influence, people of status in a society that has multiple classes? What is the political role of the Jewish nation in a global environment? The Jews are dealing with the fact that they have two kingdoms, right? He is in Judea in the south, but you have Yisrael in the north. You have Aram, which is an ally of the northern kingdom, hostile to the south. You have the Assyrians, who are invading on their way to Egypt. You have the Babylonians, who are going to come along to wipe away the Assyrians. So we're going to need to talk about what he thinks and how he advises regarding relations with those nations. We're going to talk about God's relationship with the non-Jewish nations. We've already started some references that that highlight that, as well as the question of what we expect for the time of Mashiach. There is so much more that you could do with this. You could read this on so many different levels. There's a book put out jointly by Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun and Rabbi Benny Lau called Kitziporim Afot. On Yeshaya, and one of the points that Rabbi Yoel Ben Nun makes is that you could read elements of Yeshaya as commentary and exposition of items from the Chumash, which is a fascinating idea that we're not going to go anywhere near, just because, again, there are some things you're just not going to get to. But there's layer upon layer here within this. So what we're going to do is we're going to start with some history. Those who have been here before, and I think most of the people here have been to the Tuesday classes before, but not everybody, you know that you have to interrupt me if you have a question. If you wait until the end, there will be no time. So don't, you know, don't be patient. Questions are more than welcome. And yeah, okay. Yes? Yes. I'm going to get to that in a bit. Actually, maybe the beginning of next week, we'll see, when I start talking about the book as opposed to the history of the time. But I am going to have to talk about the composition history. We're going to talk about some of it in the introduction, more of it when we get to chapter 40. But what he's referring to is, of course, the question of how many books of Isaiah are there and how many authors are there. Is this really one book by one prophet? Is it two books and there's an Isaiah and a Deutero-Isaiah? Is it even potentially three different books, as some will suggest? So we are going to have to talk about it a little bit in the beginning, and then more when we get to chapter 40, which is where the break would take place, if there is indeed such a break. Okay. History of the time, sorry.
Next year.
That's next year, yeah. Wow. That's what happens when you skip all available. Well, it would have happened anyway. No, I don't. I had copies that were over there, but they are all exhausted at this point. I will try to bring, now that we have a basic idea of registration numbers, I'll try to make sure that we have. But really, I email them out in advance, and everyone should please feel free to print at home. I will not mind. Okay. So, history. This is the middle of the first temple period, the first Beit HaMikdash period. That's where your story begins. It runs through the time when the Assyrians exile the northern kingdom, invade the southern kingdom, and are driven back. Yeshaya is a prophet for an extraordinarily long time. If you take a look quickly at chapter 6, sentence 1, and again, for anyone who doesn't have a book itself, the shul provides Tanakh, they're right there in the back, page 963. So you find there that the vision begins, the vision in chapter 6, as in the year of King Uzziyahu's death. Okay, in the year of the death of King Uzziyahu. Many believe that that's the beginning, that's really the beginning of this book. And historically, that's his first prophecy. That what's put in chapters 1 through 5 actually took place later. We're going to talk more about that when we get to chapter 1, in terms of why chapter 6 would be the opening. But now that you've seen that reference, go back to chapter 1, sentence 1, and you will see the list of kings in whose time he prophesied. So we're told, Chazon Yeshayahu ben Amoz, it's on page 955, the vision of Isaiah, which he saw regarding Yudah and Yerushalayim in the days of Uzziyahu, Yotam, Achaz, and Chizkiyahu. Those are your four kings of his period. Well, how long is that? If you flip the page for the moment to number 9, source number 9 on your source sheets. I gave you a list of kings and nations relevant for this period. The superscript number beside each name is the number of years they reigned, as recorded within Tanakh itself. So Uzziyahu, who is sometimes known as Azariah, reigns for 52 years. Yeshaya may have only begun in year 52, or earlier, as we'll have to discuss, but he got at least 1 year of Uzziyahu. 16 years of Yotam, that's 17 now. 16 years of Ahaz, that's 33. All through the time of Chizkiyahu, it appears, to Chizkiyahu's death, which means that you've got another 39 to tack on. This is a very long time. That's 72 years. And according to the Midrash, he's actually killed by Menashe, the son of Chizkiyahu, who, by the way, is Yeshaya's grandson. That's another story we have to get to. So you have a very long period of activity. Even if you assume that he only started in the last year of Uzziyahu's life, that still gives you 72 years of serving as a prophet. Not a lifetime. 72 years of serving as a prophet. Yeah.
Are we assuming any co-regency for these people?
So it's a good question. Yotam may have some period in which he has already taken power while his father Uzziyahu is still alive. But that won't affect this because, again, we're working from before that. And I think in general, it's not assumed to be the case. What happens is Uzziyahu, we're going to talk about Uzziyahu, but Uzziyahu gets Sarat at the end of his life, this ailment which may be leprosy or something else entirely, but he retreats from public view. And it sounds like Yotam may have become king while his father was still alive. So there's a possibility of co-regency at that stage. But he's a prophet, clearly, for an extended period of time, starting again in the time of Uzziyahu, whether it's the year of his death or not, we will talk about. But let me just tell you right now, I might as well, I put it on the source sheet. If you take a look at source number 7, I gave you a reference to Chronicles 2. This is for those people who missed the back of the book since we're not doing Nehemiah anymore. So you get to visit the back of the book. Chronicles 2, chapter 26, sentence 22. It is on page 1995.
Chapter 2, verse 26.
No, it's Chronicles 2. It's page 1995 in here. Oh, because you have a different... Okay, so it's Chronicles 2, chapter 26, sentence 22. So, here we are told about Yeshaya, Isaiah's activity related to Uzziyahu, and it says, Isaiah, son of Amoz, the prophet. You see that? That's what we're looking at. Recorded the rest of the earlier and later deeds of Uzziyahu. That's what suggests to us that he actually was a prophet, not just in the last year of Uzziyahu, but even earlier in time. There are other reasons to suggest it, as we'll have to see. We'll talk more about that. I mentioned that he is killed by Menashe, according to the Midrash. So just to show it to you, source number 8 on your sheets. That's the reference. Menashe harag es Yeshaya. That Menashe killed Yeshaya. And Rava, the sage, expands on this idea, explaining, Ama Rava meidan dainei vikatle. Menashe judged Yeshaya and executed him. Amarla, he said to him, Moshe Rabba Hamar Kila Yirani Ha'adam Bachai. Because look in the Torah. The Torah says, no one can see God and live. But you said in chapter 6, Va'erez Hashem Yosheva Kisei Ram Benisa, I saw God sitting on the throne. Are you contradicting the Torah? And several more iterations of this. Passages in Yeshaya that seem to contradict passages in the Chumash. Not that Menashe is this wonderfully pious person. At this stage in his life, as we will find in when we get to him, but it's explicit in Tanakh, he's busy slaughtering people and worshipping idols at this stage. He does tshuva later on. But this is not a good stage for him. This is simply, he has it in for the prophet. So Amar Yeshaya, Yeshaya says, Yadana Bejlo Mekabel Ma De'emale. Yeshaya says, he's not going to listen to me. I know that. V'emale, Ishav Yemezid. And if I answer him, So that will just make him an intentional murderer when he kills me, because he's going to do it anyway. So Omar Shem, so Isaiah does what any of us would do. He says the name of God, and Ivla Barza, and he's absorbed into a cedar tree. Right? That's what you do when you're running away. Maybe you have a better tactic, but that's what he does, but it doesn't work. Menashe figures out where he is, and he brings the tree, and he cuts off the tree. They get to his mouth. Nach nafshe, he dies. Mishum da'amar, and it's a punishment for Yeshaya, because Yeshaya said, Ubisocham tmeis vasayim anochi yoshev. It's Yeshaya chapter 6. He says, I dwell among a nation of impure lips. So he is punished by being killed in this way. This actually is based on passages within the book itself. It's a longer discussion how you get the story. You know, where does the story come from? And yeah, in another universe, we'd have time to really unpack it and discuss it now. Maybe we will eventually. But the bottom line is that the Talmud believes that Menashe is actually the one. That's not found in a biblical verse. Menashe is the one who ends the life of Yeshaya. Okay. Contemporaries of Yeshaya in the world of prophecy. The Talmud identifies three contemporaries: Hosea, Amos, and Micha, all from Treasar, from the 12 smaller books of the prophets. Yonah is also a contemporary of Yeshaya, it appears. So those are some of the figures from this period. Yes, Hosea, Amos, Micha, and Yonah. Now, the kings of his time, so if you flip the page, now we're ready for number 9. First, we're going to discuss the kings of Judea. And I'm basically just doing this straight out of the book of Melachim Bet, Kings 2. If you wanted more information about them, you could read Kings 2, chapters 14 through 21, and you'll find their stories. We're going to be referring to them a lot anyway in the course of learning Yeshaya. I start with Amatzia. Amatzia is before Yeshaya's time. He wasn't on that list that we saw. He's a righteous king. I mention him because, as we're going to see, the Midrash believes that Amatzia is Yeshaya's uncle. So that's the connection to royalty that we mentioned before. You'll see why in a few minutes. The next king after Amatzia is Uzziahu. Uzziahu is also identified sometimes as Azariah. It's the same person. He is a conqueror. He is described as being righteous at one point in Tanakh. He accomplishes a great deal in terms of agriculture, developing the land, in terms of war, in terms of expanding the economy. As a matter of fact, I remember reading that David Ben-Gurion considered him a model, considered Uzziahu a role model for what he did in terms of building up the land of Israel. And not just in Yerushalayim. Where else were the Migdalim? You remember? Because that's the key one. You're right. The song "Va'yiben Uzziyahu Migdalim b'Yerushalayim," right? That's about the towers that he built in Yerushalayim. But the other place he built towers was the Negev, which was Ben Gurion's vision for building up the Negev. He built up towers in the Negev to protect trade routes. That was the idea, but that's Uzziahu. Unfortunately, Uzziahu gets into a lot of trouble, and that's the business with the tzaraat that he has. He becomes arrogant. We're going to learn more about him when we get to the fourth and fifth chapters of Yeshaya. That will become more relevant. That's the one in whose time Yeshaya begins. At the end of the reign of Uzziahu, the southern kingdom and the northern kingdom both go into decline. They had been very wealthy in his day. The king in the north, we'll get to, was Yeroboam ben Yoash. But then things deteriorate. However, the next king is a fellow by the name of Yotam. Yotam is righteous. The nation is idolatrous in his day. He reigns for 16 years. During this period, Assyria becomes a force. Interestingly, Yeshaya has nothing to say to him. We find no visions of Yeshaya to Yotam. We find him talking to Uzziahu. We find him talking to Chizkiyahu. We find him talking to Ahaz. He never talks to Yotam in any recorded parts of the book. keep in mind, that doesn't mean there never was any communication. It just means it doesn't survive in Sefer Yeshayah. For whatever reason, it wasn't deemed worthy of preservation. But it's also possible that he was such a good king that, well, I don't need to bother him. I have nothing really to say to him. Don't know. But after him is King Ahaz. And King Ahaz is an idolater. He loses land of Judea to an invasion by the northern kingdom, Yisrael, and Aram. Yes, it's Jews fighting against Jews. We excel at that. Ahaz feels threatened by the northern kingdom, and on the other hand, he feels threatened by the Assyrians. And this is a major focus of Yeshayah in the beginning of the book, is trying to reassure Ahaz and say to him, don't turn to Assyria for support, don't turn to your neighbors for support, it's going to be okay. And Ahaz says, I don't know what you're talking about, it's not okay, we're in trouble, we're facing invasion from either one side or the other, but we're in trouble. And that becomes a major focus of chapter 7, 8, 9 in this book. Yes?
If Ahaz was an idolater, why would Yeshayahu give him so much support? Politics,
he's the king of Judea. He's the king of, that's the answer. He's the king of Judea. He is the one.
Who, yeah. The rules that Yeshayahu was trying to inculcate.
Yeah.
Okay. And you're just saying Yeshayahu tries to encourage him to hang on to everything
you're going
to
do. Oh, no. Okay, so I need to, first, could someone go close those doors back there? I'm getting noise from outside. Thank you. When I say encourage, I don't mean he's saying to him, Ahaz, you're a good man. You will see that he never says, Ahaz, you're a good man. What he is saying to him is, stay the course, don't form alliances with the Assyrians, don't form alliances with Aram, don't form alliances with Israel in the north. He's no fan of Ahaz, and you'll see it become very clear as we read it. Yeah. No, encouragement means different things to different people. Then you get Hezekiah. Hezekiah was wonderful. He's one of the top kings in Tanakh. Superlatively righteous. Yeshayah even prophesied that he is going to be Mashiach, as we will see. However, Hezekiah has his issues. He submits to the Assyrians. Yeshayah is not happy about that. Then he rebels against the Assyrians and he destroys idolatry in the land, perhaps due to Yeshayah's influence on him. There's a back and forth. A lot of the issue of international politics comes from the dialogue between Yeshayah and Hezekiah regarding the Assyrians and what tack he should take. Debbie, you were going to say? Okay. And then, of course, you get Menashe, who kills Yeshayah according to the Midrash that we already saw. Menashe submits to the Assyrians. There's much more to say about Menashe, his wickedness, and then his later repentance, but again, not for right now. I also listed the kings of Yisrael in source number 9. We're not going to spend time discussing them, but I want to highlight for you the first one there, Yeravam ben Yoash, because he is the one who expands the northern kingdom. They do very well under him. And then look what happens. You have Zechariah for 6 months, Shalom for 1 month. This wasn't because they caught a cold during their inaugural address. This was because of coups and assassinations. Then Menachem, who survives for 10 years, followed by Pekahia for 2 years, and then Pekah. And Pekah is going to be important as well. Pekah ben Remaliahu is going to be a very important figure in the time of King Ahaz. And then the one after him is Hoshea. That's not the prophet Hoshea. That's Hoshea ben Elah, who is the one to finally... He is the king when the Assyrians do away with the northern kingdom and exile the 10 tribes. He's the last one holding the keys. Okay, the nations around us, I just referenced here very quickly. There are other nations around us, but these are the 4 key players for us. Aram, they are allies of the northern kingdom. They are roughly where Syria is today. That's more or less what you're talking about. Then you have Assyria, who is off to the east. They are a rising power. Their method of conquest is that they transfer populations. They conquer the northern kingdom eventually and exile the 10 tribes. That's where you get the idea of the 10 lost tribes. They move some of their other conquests into that land. Those become the Samaritans, who we learned about in Ezra and Nehemiah. Assyrians invade Judea. They're stopped short at Jerusalem by a miracle in the days of King Hezekiah. Then you have Babel, the Babylonians, who will come along to rout the Assyrians. And then you have the Persians. The Persians don't really belong on this list. They're only here because Yeshaya is going to predict by name the rise of King Cyrus of Persia, who will defeat the Babylonians and who will permit the Jews to return to build the second temple. And that's going to be something we're going to have to talk about quite obviously. Chapters 43, 44, 45. That's going to be a major focus. Okay. But yeah, they're not so relevant yet. They're not relevant at all as an empire in his time, except that Yeshaya, for some reason, mentions them. Yeshaya never met a Persian. He never knew anything about them. Nonetheless, he predicts this. So, the book itself. The Talmud envisions this book as a book of consolation. I brought you something interesting here in source number 10. It's kind of funny because the first chapter is such a horror show of, I'm going to destroy the temple, I don't like these Jews, I don't want them bringing their celebration offerings to me, I don't want them celebrating my holidays. The first chapter looks so angry and so hostile. But take a look at source number 10. This is a section in the Talmud that discusses the order of books in Tanakh. Now, the way we structure the books in Tanakh is chronological, meaning the books of the prophets are Joshua, right, when the Jews enter Israel under Joshua, so that's your beginning, then Shoftim, the judges, then Shmuel, who is the last of the judges, and he is the one who crowns Saul, David, and then Malachim, the kings. And then after that, we get Nevi'im Achronim, the later prophets. So you get Yeshaya, and then you get Yirmiyahu, and then you get Yechezkel, and then Treyasar, the 12 smaller books of the prophets, which are grouped together as 12, because if you put them individually, they get lost, because like some of them are one chapter long or two chapters long. But but Yeshaya, Yirmiyah, Yechezkel is the order we use. And that makes a lot of sense, because it's chronological. Yeshaya is, as I mentioned, prophet middle of the First Temple period. Yirmiyahu is the end of the First Temple period. And then Yechezkel is the end of the First Temple period into the Babylonian exile. It flows very well. But in the days of the Talmud, that was not the way they did it. The way that they did it was that they actually did Malachim, kings, then Yirmiyahu, then Yechezkel, and then Yeshaya. Which doesn't make any sense. And not only that, Encyclopedia Mikra'it is of the theory that that's the way Tanakh was taught in schools back in the day. When the Talmud says this is how we do it, it's not simply we put together our scrolls and we align them this way. This is where they appear on the shelf. But actually, this is the way you taught it. Why? Source number 10, the Talmud explains why they did it. They ask the question, Michti Yeshaya Kadim Yirmiyah v'Yechezkel. Isaiah is before. Yeshaya is before Yirmiyah and Yechezkel. Liktame li Yeshaya v'Resha. Let Yeshaya be first. Kevan de Malachim Sofei Churbana. But the answer is, the end of Malachim, the end of the book of Kings, is destruction. It's all destruction there. V'Yirmiyah Kulei Churbana. And Yirmiyah is all about destruction. It really is all about destruction. Then after that, Yechezkel Reshei Churbana, the beginning of Yechezkel is the destruction of the first temple. The Seife Nechemta, but then it ends with comfort. It talks about visions of a future messianic time, a rebuilding of the temple. He gives you the plans for the temple. So that's already on the upswing. And then they do Yeshaya. The Yeshaya Kulei Nechemta. Yeshaya, no matter what you think of the opening part of the book, is all consolation. The Samchinon Churbana Churbana Menachemta Lachemta. So we put destruction with destruction, comfort with comfort. It's thematic in its organization instead of chronological. That's the way that the Talmud views it. They think Yeshaya is a nice, happy book. For those of you who saw my flyer, Reckoning is Coming, you know that I have a little bit of a different focus as I read it. I don't see it as being all comforting at all. But certainly there is a dominant element of comfort, which we will see as we go through the book. Yeah, Debbie?
What if you use the word redemption instead? Mm-hmm. That's got more layers.
That's true. That's true.
That maybe takes us both places here.
Right.
That's,
you could.
When I
hear you.
In the summer, that's what I think. No instruction.
Right. Everyone heard that? She did the reading over the summer. That's. There we go.
I have no life.
The Redemption, I hear you. I mean, redemption, or the term that's used repeatedly within the prophets, the day of God, right? Which for some people is positive redemption, and for some people it's the day of reckoning and punishment. I could hear that type of a description. I have a hard time thinking that the entire book is consolation. That doesn't really seem to fit. Yeah, it really is comfort. Yeah, but that's the way they looked at it. The storyline of the book. So it's a little bit disjointed in the sense that the opening chapters are more philosophical than story. Although once you know the history, which we're going to be doing, you realize it's philosophy that is actually a targeted message to King Uzziah. It's not just somebody talking about good behavior. It's a rebuke of a wealthy king. That's what you're going to see in the beginning. Then you get an actual formal story part with King Ahaz, who wants to capitulate to either the Assyrians or the Arameans, and Yeshaya telling him not to. Then you get this big chunk, chapters 13 to 35, which offer a vision of future reckoning for those who have sinned among the Jews and among the nations. Then you get story part number two, which is the peace with King Chizkiyahu, dealing with the Assyrians and the Assyrian invasion. And then you get the last chapters of the book, chapters 40 to 66, which focus on a future period of redemption. That's the part that is clearly consolation. At the end, that's the part that some would call the second Isaiah, because it really does have a focus that differs from what came before it. And again, we're going to have to talk more about this question of, is it one book or is it two books? We'll talk a little bit more about it shortly, and much more about it when we get to chapter 40. Okay, themes of the book. The one major theme is defining righteousness. What does righteous human activity look like? Whether you read the book over the summer or did not, what do you know about Yeshaya and his definition of righteous human activity? What does he consider important? We've already discussed some of it, and you go back to the beginning of what we talked about today. Shana.
Being decent to people.
Right. Ben Adam, the way that you deal with other human beings, so much so that he seems to believe if you take care of that, everything else will fall into place. If you can manage your human relationships, everything else is going to work out. Take a look at page 955, please, as an example of this. It's chapter 1, sentences 16 to 18. In Isaiah. We're going to be for a while. Yeah. So this is his set of instructions to the Jews he has just rebuked. Wash yourselves, right? You see that? Rachatsu hizaku. Wash yourselves, purify yourselves. Hasiru ra ma'alalechem mineged einai. Remove the evil of your deeds from before my eyes. Chidlu areya. Cease to do bad things. So what do I want you to do? Limdu heitev. Learn to do good things. Dirshu mishpat. Seek justice. Ashru chamotz. You should praise chamotz. Chamotz is the person who has been harmed. You should build up the person who has been harmed. Shiftu yatom. Judge the case of the orphan. Rivu almana. You should fight on behalf of the widow. And then God promises, luchunavni v'chayomar Hashem. God says, then we're going to have a discussion when you do that. If your sins are as red wool, kashela gyalbinu, they will be white like snow. If they are red like tola, they will be made white like wool. All you have to do is get your act together in terms of how you deal with other human beings, and especially the way you look after the vulnerable. We saw, I listed for you before, 11 times where he talked about tzedakah u'mishpat, tzedek u'mishpat, righteousness and justice. That's a major piece for Yeshaya, a major theme. And then another major theme of the book is the question of, should we form political alliances with the nations around us, which I've already referenced. I'm not going to belabor the point. But he believes that you should not form alliances. don't look for support from others, don't capitulate, don't make deals. And you know, the kings have a little bit of a different perspective. But that's his belief. We should be a proud nation that stands alone. That's the way that he looks at it. Janine.
Is he saying that that doing good, treating your fellow man well, is it? Or is he saying that that's a necessary, that it's necessary in order to continue?
Okay, so yeah. So to be clear, Yeshaya is not jettisoning the importance of Ben Adam LaMakom, the way that we relate to God. He is not dumping all of the mitzvot that are ritual mitzvot that are about God. He very clearly shows that karbanot are important, ritual sacrifice is important. He has a couple of places where he talks about the importance of Shabbat and Yom Tov, the holidays. He's not saying you don't need to worry about the relationship with God. But what he is saying is, that's not what's earning you the destruction of the temple. The destruction that you're seeing, that's coming about because you took advantage of the vulnerable and weren't good in terms of the practice of basic righteousness and justice with others. It's reminiscent of the Talmud in Shabbat, which talks about the six questions a person is going to be asked, right, when a person enters the next world. So based on, actually, a sentence in Yeshaya. That pasuk is, I believe, Yeshaya. The Talmud says there are six questions a person is going to be asked. And the first question they're going to be asked is, what is it? Sorry, I heard a lot of different answers here. Well, business being a major focus, but in general, were your dealings with others in good faith? Nasata v'natata be'emuna. Did you deal with others in good faith? I don't think it's business specific, although you're right. Masau matan is a term that we use for commerce, and it's nasata v'natata as the verbs in that clause. But the very first one is, were you honest in business? I don't imagine that if somebody gets up there and says, I was honest in business, bless you, and I went and worshipped idolatry every week, I don't think that they're going to get a good hearing. But the first question you're asked is that one. Yes?
In the davening for Yom Kippur that we just went through, we can start all over making mistakes.
Okay? Yes.
Most of it, I noticed, a certain whole section is Al Cheshachatano to other people.
Yes, a lot of the emphasis in that list is absolutely social. Absolutely, absolutely agreed. He has a focus as well. Those are in terms of righteousness, the importance of how we relate to others, the idea that the nation should not turn to other nations for support, they should turn to God. A major focus for him is the relationship with God. He spends a lot of time in the latter chapters on the difference between himself and the idols that people worship. Highlighting the differences. The book has a very strong emphasis on the idea that God is the manipulator of history. He will elevate nations and he will lower nations to advance particular purposes. Sacrifice, the korbanot, is important, although once again, he predicates it on the way you deal with other people. If you're very horrific to other people, he isn't interested in your celebration and in your korban. He says that explicitly in the first chapter, right? Since we're on the page anyway, page 955. He says, no, but one in particular, sentence 13, the end of sentence 13, he says, Chodesh v'Shabbat k'ro mikra. You're going to gather together on Chodesh, today's Rosh Chodesh. You're going to gather together on the new month. You're going to gather together on Shabbat. Lo uchal aven va'atzara. I have no patience for people who commit aven. Aven is corruption. I have no patience for people who commit corruption and then want to hold ritual celebration, atzara, like atzeret. The two, as far as Yeshaya is concerned, don't go together. So you have your first theme of righteous human activity, your second in terms of the relationship with God, and then the third of the three themes I'm going to highlight is the future. He envisions a future time when all will be at peace, when everybody will recognize God, and everybody will recognize God's nation. One thing that we will have to discuss, as early as chapters 2, 3, 4, is the question of what is the role of the nations of the world in the time of Mashiach? This future time, does he envision them all becoming Jewish? Does he envision them simply accepting God and the seven laws that are common to all humanity? What exactly does he think is going to happen for them? We're going to have to talk about that. He has visions of our return from exile, which parallel in many ways the return from Egypt. And there'll be a lot more to say about that as well. Last bit here. Authorship of the book. So if you take a look on your sheet at source number 11, the Talmud states, Chizkiah v'si'ato katvu Yeshaya Mishlei Shir Ashirim v'Kohelet, that Chizkiyahu and his associates, King Chizkiyahu and his associates, wrote, and it lists three books that are associated with King Solomon: Mishlei, Proverbs, Song of Songs, and Ecclesiastes, Kohelet. But it also lists Yeshaya. Well, that's very interesting, because they're contemporaries. But Yeshaya doesn't write his own book. Somebody else wrote it. Well, why didn't Yeshaya write it? Right? Why do I need Chizkiyahu and his anonymous crew to write that book? So Rashi believes that it's recorded after Yeshaya's death. The problem is that it's also after Chizkiyahu's death. Right? Because he's supposed to be prophet through the time of Chizkiyahu, especially according to the Gemara, that he's killed by Menashe. So the Dan Mikra edition, which I favor for learning Yeshaya, suggests that the evidence for the idea that it's written by Chizkiyahu and a group of others is actually in the book itself. Because Yeshaya speaks repeatedly about students, and about students to whom he's delivering the prophecies, and students who are writing them down. So it's not actually being recorded, and certainly it's not being published in his lifetime. And that becomes really important when we get to the question of the Persian prediction. Where the Gemara just says the whole book.
The whole book was written by someone else.
So it appears. Yeah. Yeah. That's what it looks like. Well, here's the thing. Yeshaya makes a prediction to Jews who have not yet been conquered by the Babylonians, that a nation is going to rise with a king by the name of Cyrus, and that he is going to punish the Babylonians and allow the Jews to come back. As I said before, Yeshaya couldn't have met a Persian. They weren't a thing, so to speak, while he was alive. The people he's speaking to as his audience don't know what he's talking about. They haven't even been exiled yet, and you're already talking about what's going to happen 70 years later. They don't know what a Cyrus is. And what's their reaction when Cyrus shows up? Suddenly there's a Cyrus. And by the way, Cyrus the Great, who conquers the Babylonians, is actually the second King Cyrus for the Persians. One wonders what the Jews were doing when there was the first King Cyrus. What did they do with Cyrus the First? They get all excited and then found, oh, it's the wrong Cyrus, I guess. There's another Cyrus coming. So the answer offered in the Dot Mikra edition is that this was one of the prophecies that was given to the students, but it wasn't published. Meaning they held on to it until such time as it would be relevant to let everybody know about it. It's not relevant when they haven't even gone into exile yet. And that's part of this idea that it's Chizkiyahu and crew who put together this book, and in which case it's not just at one point, but it's over a period of time. Last note, and then we're going to, I think, break there and then resuming next week. There are parallel sections between Yeshaya and elsewhere in Tanakh. I was going to have it on the sheet, but then it was going to make the sheet too long, and that's a cardinal sin. But there are sections in Yeshaya chapter 2 that appear in Micha chapter 4. We already have noted that there are two visions of the divine throne room. Yeshaya has his in chapter 6, and Yechezkel chapter 1. There are parallel sections in Kings 2, Malachim Bet, and Devarayamim Bet, Chronicles 2, that flesh out some of the stories here. What this is going to mean is, as we go through this book, we will be looking at other books as well within Tanakh in order to get a fuller picture of where things are. So I look forward to continuing next week. I am so glad that you're all here. I'm glad to see many old faces, people who were here for Ezra Nehemiah, people who I haven't seen in a while. Please do please do follow up with me by email for questions that come up for you during the class and we don't get to. I am more than happy to hold your email for 2 weeks before responding. No, I'm just kidding. I'm more than happy to try to respond by email. Again, I'm going to send out a link once we have a complete list. I'll send out the link to where you can download the audios online. Next week, God willing, we will finish the introduction and we'll actually start on Yeshaya itself. Thank you very much.